Like the conversations you hear on Basic Folk with your favorite roots artists? Then join Back Catalog Listening Party, a weekly podcast where you can dig deeper into their catalog. Top songwriters like Mary Gaucher, Chris Smither, Dar Williams, and Lizzie Ngo join host Mother Banjo and Anthony Earig to talk about their old albums with a live online audience. Listen wherever you get your podcasts and learn about attending live tapings at backcataloglisteningparty.com/join. Hello, and welcome to Basic Folk, where we have honest conversations with folk musicians on the Bluegrass Situation podcast network. I'm your host, Cindy Howes, and today we have another edition of Folk Debate Club. It is ambition versus acceptance. Lizzie's going to give us a great intro, but before we get to that, let's talk about our newsletter. Are you on our email list? You should totally be on our email list. You can sign up for it at the link in the show notes, or you can go to basicfolk.com. We are also listener supported, so if you would be so inclined to throw us some dollar bills, you can do so at the link in the show notes, or you can go to basicfolk.com. Follow us on social media. We are at Basic Folk Pod, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, and TikTok. All right, let's get to it on Folk Debate Club. I'll let Lizzie take it away here on Basic Folk.
Welcome to Folk Debate Club, our occasional debate series. Today, to discuss ambition versus acceptance, we welcome our illustrious regular panel, music journalist and author Kim Rule. Hi, Kim.
Hello.
Basic Folk boss Cindy Howes.
Hello.
And yours truly, Lizzie Ngo. We are sending love to Issa Burke, who is loving on and caring for a family member right now. We love you, Issa, and we miss you. Now, let me extend a very warm welcome to our special guests, musicians and podcasters, Michaela Ann and Aaron Schaefer-Hase, hosts of the Other 22 Hours podcast.
Hey, thanks for having
us. Hi.
Welcome aboard.
Thank you for having us. We're happy to be here.
I'm happy to be talking to you and seeing that you are in Aaron's childhood bedroom, the beginning of the ambitions. The dream began right in that room.
Literally right where I'm sitting, I think. Drums are my first instrument. And when I moved up to my second drum set, you know, and things started to get real, I pretty much had it set up right here where I'm sitting right now. Epicenter.
You're in the right frame of mind.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I was going to say there's a further ambition connection, though, because we are on family vacation, and yet we are doing a podcast interview.
Which is
the story of our lives and a lot of musicians' lives. Freelance artistic endeavor, whatever. It's just like there's a very blurred line between free time, family time, and work time.
This doesn't feel
like work, though.
You could say that. And, you know, a wise person once told me, and I'm going to share it with you now, that if you do what you love, you'll never work a day in your life.
Mm-hmm. I've blended
That's
that
free
too.
Free advice.
Yeah. I've blended that too. If you do what you love, you'll have horrible work-life balance and you'll work every day of your life.
Negative of you. Okay, wait, let's start with some definitions before we like fully go off the rails and share all of our hot takes about ambition and acceptance. Okay, a working definition of ambition is a strong desire to do or achieve something, typically requiring determination and hard work. Another word that comes to mind in this conversation is aspiration, which is a strong desire to achieve something high or great, a drawing of something in, out, up, or through, by, or as if by suction.
Whoa.
Such as the act of breathing, and especially breathing in and sweating out. So like getting sweaty and breathing heavily.
That's how you achieve your dreams.
By suction, we achieve our dreams. It's a random definition, but I actually do think it's helpful to think about the sweat and the breathing and the blood and the tears and the physical side of working really, really hard. Let's start with a general question, and I want to throw it to Kim first. How do you relate to both of these words, aspiration, ambition? How do you think they fit into our folk and roots adjacent music worlds?
Ask the words lady.
Yeah, words lady.
I have so many thoughts and feelings, but I'm going to start with how they fit into the folk and roots world, because the way that musical genres were created back in the day, when country and Western was split off from race music.
Let's go, Kim.
Let's go there. and then folk, you know, on its own, in its own life was originally did not include protest music. It did not include religious music. It did not include a lot of the stuff that is considered folk music now. But it was also relegated to the margins. You know, it's not pop music. It wasn't Tin Pan Alley. So all this to say that the level of ambition available to folk musicians, race musicians, I did quotation marks there. And
thank you for letting us know in the audio medium.
I always forget to do that. And other other forms of music that were speaking on behalf of, you know, working people. The level you could possibly reach was very limited, mm-hmm. remains very limited. And so even the most ambitious folkies, let's talk about, you know, Ani DiFranco, mm-hmm. like, she has become iconic because our generation is getting old now. But even in her heyday in the 90s, it was just like handing tapes around. Mm. You know, she made it to the cover of Spin magazine, but for a half second, she wasn't being played on TRL. The amount yeah. of money and longevity of career and all that stuff that you get if you're Madonna, talk about Blonde Ambition, or Taylor Swift, mm-hmm. or whoever, it's just not available to folk singers. And it never has been and never will be, even in the 60s. Like Bob Dylan would not have been played on TRL.
And I accept that.
That's, me too. That's totally fine. So, as a folk music journalist who has been like, who has sat happily in my niche for 20 years, like, I'm not getting hired by, you know, fill in the blank, big time, you know, Oprah magazine to write about. I say Oprah because she pays like $2 a word.
What?
Yeah. But that money is not coming to me. You know, like you have to write about Taylor Swift and, mm-hmm. and you know, I don't know, whoever, Chapel Roan, whoever's the big thing mm-hmm. of the moment. So we're all just kicking it here in our little marginalized crew of people who managed to get what Dar Williams called folk famous.
Kim, I really appreciate that you setting that container, because what we're talking about is like roots music. You know, mm-hmm. it's not the NBA. The heights are only so high. But a lot of us within it, yeah, are still very ambitious. I want to throw a question to Michaela about like early days. What ambition looked like for you when you were starting your career? Can you think of any role models that you had? Like, were there artists where you were like, I want that career? And you worked to mold your career after them. And then has your perspective on them changed over time as you've gained more experience?
Yeah, I always say that my path to becoming a musician, especially in the like folk Americana world, was very almost late. Like, I didn't grow up knowing about this world. I didn't go mm-hmm. to festivals or camps as a kid. I didn't learn about who my favorite artists are today, like Lucinda Williams and Emmylou Harris, who are obviously, Emmylou Harris was much more mainstream, successful and famous until college. Mm-hmm. So I was very much like, I didn't know I was a musician since I was 5 years old and always playing music and went to jazz school, but I didn't know what a career path was because I thought it was like pop stardom or nothing. And I mm-hmm. knew I didn't want pop stardom, that I just didn't have the personality for that. So it took me a really long time to figure out, where do I go? And I started in a jazz world in New York City, but met Michael Daves and started to learn about the bluegrass and community and like jalopy and the folk scene, and started just kind of, I didn't have a clear vision. It was very much like, well, I guess I got to play songs at a bar. I'll learn a bunch of country songs mm-hmm. and started playing every local cover gig I could in New York City. And then Aaron and I were dating back then, and he was like, oh, I started working at Nonesuch Records. So I, right out of college, and that introduced me to, like, I'd never heard of Nickel Creek. Mm-hmm. I had never heard of Punch Brothers had just formed. So I got introduced to all this great music. But it really, for me, was like slowly piecemealing ideas. And Aaron was like, you should make a record. I was right. Started writing songs, and very slow. Like, I didn't know what Americana was. I didn't know what Newport Folk Festival. I didn't know any of this stuff. So I don't think I had an example or a vision for a really long time. And then I kind of started to become aware of like Folk Alliance and mm-hmm. would go there and the path of the circuit and Americana Fest, and very slowly started to piece it together. But to be honest, I mean, I started putting out records in my mid to late 20s. So I feel like I was late in a lot mm-hmm. of ways of our idea of what your age path should be. And I'm 38 now. And I feel like I now have a clear vision of what I wanted. And I spent the last several years looking at what other people did and thinking, okay, that's what I got to do. I got to get the big booking agent. I got to play these clubs. I got to get booked at these venues. And only in the past several years have I been like, wait, is that what I want to do? Or is that just the mold? So it's taken me a long time to realize, like, do I want to play Newport? Or is that just what everyone says mm-hmm. is what you're supposed to want if you're in this path? So, I mean, I always loved, you know, Linda Ronstadt's career, not because she was super famous, but because she did whatever she musically wanted. Mm. And that's what I've always wanted to emulate of, I don't want to be pigeonholed into one genre, essentially.
Mm-hmm. That reminds me of like what I love so much about this, that the most recent Kathleen Edwards album, like a woman who's like a few records in talking about total freedom and what it means to like have autonomy and be connected to other people. Like, those are the nitty-gritty stories that I wish we were hearing more when it comes to ambition and career success.
Mm-hmm. I think I've thought a lot about this stuff, but I think what can be confused is your ideal and your goals with then what you think you need to do for survival, to just like make a living, mm-hmm. be included. So that stuff can get really blurred of like, well, maybe total freedom looks like this, but that means that I won't be making a living or being, you know, included in the scene or the awards mm-hmm. or whatever, and getting to a place where you don't care anymore, I think is the goal, I think.
Yeah. Kim, I think you were.
Yeah, I think, you know, as with everything, like, the problem is that we are taught to conflate music with music business. And that, like, really fucks with, I don't know if I can say that word on
Hell yeah.
podcast, but it totally fucks with an artist's sort of sense of self and sense of vision and purpose, because you feel like in order to do what your mind and heart and body do as an artist, you have to make it fit into a marketable, tangible item, or now intangible item, and find some way to make money off of it. So, you know, as always, capitalism is the problem. And, you know, like I want to,
we're 15 minutes in and we've already denounced capitalism.
I want to separate. I just want to, like, I'm really interested in the idea of separating out, taking the business out of the conversation and talking about, like, what we want to do with art and what art is capable of doing and what artists and people who are here to support artists are capable of doing for the sake of art, mm-hmm. and not for the sake of money or airplay or all that stuff. And of course, you know, that's not, we live in a world where we have to pay rent. So,
yeah.
Or mortgage or whatever, but I'm curious from, and not, you know, I'm curious to learn from Lizzie and Aaron and Michaela, like, as artists, like, how do you, what do you think of, like, that? What's your ambition for your art that has nothing to do with selling shit?
Okay. Nina Simone said it. We don't need to say anything else. To me, it's like total freedom is no fear. And, like, I want to be making music that is useful to the movement for human freedom. And that means making, like, expansive art that touches people individually and as a group. And is, like, scraped from my deepest insides. That's my ambition, always. Mm-hmm. Mm.
You can go first, Aaron, because you haven't spoken yet.
Okay. Affirmative action response.
For the white man. We were actually legally required to bring Aaron into this conversation, and it was against our will.
Well, I have a different perspective because I have never been a front man, and I've never wanted to be a front man. I've never wanted to lead my own project. So my career started as a sideman, where my responsibility was to bring somebody else's vision to life, like, as quickly as possible, as clearly as possible. And now, as a producer, it's that even more closely related to the artist. And it's like, how do I help you scrape your insides so that you can make truthful art? And that has always been my approach as a producer, is that, like, it's no secret, you know, to bring capitalism back into it, that, you know, even the biggest records are not selling like they did in 1998. And so to me, the value is longevity and making things that do not expire. They don't, you know, which to me is not chasing a fad, which is not chasing what's popular right now. It's what is rooted in who you are and your unique voice. You know, I was born and raised on, like, the Talking Heads, the Grateful Dead, the Band, like, all of these people that have a very strong, singular sound. They knew what their voice was. They knew the music they wanted to make, and they leaned into that. They kind of, like, bucked all of these trends that were happening before. It's, you know, the Band gets kind of mushed in because they were with Dylan, all that. But, like, you hear, you know, 30 seconds of the Band and you're like, that's the Band, you know? And so I view my role as a producer to help artists step into that and to help artists break through the, like, well, this playlist or Noah Kahan is doing this or blah, blah, blah. I'm like, who? Well, he did that. Cool. Great. Like, let him do that. What is your voice? Because that, to me, as a listener, is what resonates and what grabs my attention. And it's also, like, I realize, you know, I might find a record that was put out in, like, 1993, but it sounds really cool. It doesn't sound like, you know, I don't know, name any band that was big in 1994. You know, it sounds unique. And to me, Blind Melon came to mind for me. But, you know, we're not... All of those, I think, all those bands we just named had unique sounds in 1993. You know, it's not the 50 other bands that then followed that trend to that, you know, they happened to make millions of dollars because that's what you did at the time. But all three of the bands that just came out, like, have a very unique, individualized sound. And so to me, it's like, follow that and chase that. And that's what's going to last. And, you know, being in a world, in the studio world now, and not in performing, you know, live for the most part, making a record is like making a sculpture, and we want to make art that will outlive us. you know, and in doing that, you have to step into who you are as an artist and what your unique voice is.
Yeah, I'll say it's been very helpful. I think so much of this is like personal journeys of like a process, and I'm in a place and I feel very grateful that I have a friend group that's in a similar place in their career where we've all kind of had like our new buzzy moments and then seen the kind of backside of it and have experienced what it feels like to like have the buzzy record. And then you put out the next record and it's same people that were all excited about you or don't even recognize that you put out a record. And I've talked about this a lot with friends of like how personally you can take that, because it's not like that last record that was buzzy and getting a lot of attention was written or made with the intention to like get attention. It just happened. Mm-hmm. You know, I've never been able to, I don't make pop music, but it feels really good to be validated and to be celebrated and to be accepted by all these circles that, you know, and to hear yes for once that, oh, wow, and get offers and it just all starts flowing and you think, okay, this is it. And then it doesn't continue. It continues like little bits here and there, but that's like most people's experience is it's a lot of up and down. You don't like hit a home run every time. And I have benefited from having Aaron as my life partner and creative partner to remind me like, okay, you're letting some outside stuff really skew your perspective. I kind of the last few years have been like, my career's over. And he's like, really? You've played Bonnaroo, you've been on tour with the Milk Carton Kids and the Wood Brothers, you played Hardly Strictly. Yeah, your career is sucky. And I'm like, yeah, I can't like see through a different lens. So it's been a process for me to renegotiate my relationship with my work, regardless of how it's perceived by or how it's recognized. Because also so much of this stuff that we get caught up in business has nothing to do with our art. It's what else is going on that month? What else a journalist or show has going on that they can't fit, whatever. Like, but we take it so personally. Emily Scott Robinson on our podcast said she's really learned that she can't take, she's always been told don't take negative press personally. But she was like, I've really learned I cannot take the good press personally either. Because I think, see, look, I'm being rewarded. I did the right thing. I excavated my heart and soul. And this is proving to me that I'm
good.
Yeah. Yeah. And she's like, that's a trap too. So for me, it's really, I have to restructure like, you know, certain songs of mine that I've put out and it didn't, nothing supposedly happened. And then I'll get a DM from somebody who's going through a divorce and told me that like a song gave them the language to try and see their ex-partner and with compassion, empathy. And I'm like, okay, that's the stuff. That's what you have to focus on and kind of constantly remind yourself of like what you said, Lizzie, of like connecting to help people rather than getting caught up in the video game of achievement in the business of music, which really is what it starts to feel like.
You know, it's interesting. I've been thinking about this a lot recently because I think so many of these moments where we feel like we're not achieving what we should be achieving are opportunities to like educate our audience. Because I was just complaining to a friend of mine about this very thing of like when an audience member comes up to you and like, they're like, what are you doing in this small room? You should be playing an arena. And it's like, that's very nice of you, but you know, what you're saying is what I have isn't enough. And I feel like the only way that I'm able to combat those like really dark days of like, it's over, I'm not growing, is to like, remember how individual your journey is. And like, if someone's saying like, what are you doing in this small room? What I feel is like an indignation of like, well, I'm paying my bills with my music, which I never thought I would do. Like, I didn't quit in spite of all of the obstacles that I've been through. And like, just the fact that we remain is enough for me at this moment. But we do have this capitalist idea that if we're not constantly growing exponentially, we are failing. But like, the math doesn't math, right? Like, every single artist can't be exponentially growing at all times, because there's not that, that's not sustainable. Yeah, I think it's like, we have to like, as artists and as audiences, unlearn the capitalist mindset. And know that, like, if there are still people listening to your music and you're still playing it, that's a success.
Well, yeah, I would like to point out that all of this talk is on the commercial side and on the business mm-hmm. side. If we're not growing monetarily, if we're not mm-hmm. growing size-wise, and traditionally, that has been the artist's responsibility.
Yeah.
To me, that's the responsibility of the agent. That's the responsibility of the record label. It's like, you make me grow. You make the crowd size grow. You make the record sales grow. What I'm going to do is make my art grow. I'm going to make my vision grow. And each record, I'm going to be closer to my purest artistic vision.
Right.
I'm going to write songs that are more closely aligned with who I am. I'm going to realize them in a way that's more closely aligned with my pure artistic vision. And I'm going to give that to you, and you're going to do that. So what happens, what I'm seeing is, like, artists are a victim to a failing music industry.
Right.
That it took it so easily from the 90s, when they could just print their own money and literally put whatever out. Somebody would go to the store and pay $19 because they heard one song on the radio. Like, what? That's insane. Mm-hmm. You know? And that became, they became complacent. And they really, there was no progress on their part. There was no, you know, there was no development. There was no, you know,
creativity
really on their part. And what we're having to burden now as artists is their failures to step up. And
yikes,
you know,
you're right. Damn, I gotta make some mean phone calls.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. You know, they're like, ooh, we messed up and now it's on us. And it's like, it's not. And you know what, the whole industry is changing, that we don't really need you. Yeah. It's going to be a part that we don't, you know, if we're going to carry this burden, we're going to do this work and take all these responsibilities, fine, we're going to do that, but you're not getting any part of this now.
From an audience perspective, and Kim, help me out here, because I mean, Kim has been on both sides of the stage here. She's was a musician, and now she's a music journalist and also a music fan. But hearing Aaron talk about how he wants to cultivate his truest artistic vision versus trying to get money, from an audience perspective, like, I want Aaron to find his truest artistic vision. Like, I don't give it, like, I don't care about how much money these record companies and agents are making. And it feels like in 2024, audience members, especially in our world, have way more empathy for artists than they did, say, back in the rolling 90s, like in, you know, 1997.
Yeah, absolutely. Chris Smither said in our conversation with him, I'm pretty sure it was Chris, said the audience wants us to succeed. Mm-hmm. You know, they're on our team. We're all a team together. And it's like, yeah, exactly that. There's a lot of empathy, I think.
Yeah, I think that... we need you to make us cry, and then recover from crying. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, especially right now in history, like, there's been so much trauma in this, you know, like, I mean, there's always a lot of trauma, but like, there's been so much broadcasted trauma and shared trauma, and, you know, that, we need you guys to, when we go to a show, to like take us on a journey through our feelings. Mm-hmm. And in order for you to do that, we need you to feel all the feelings and figure out what to say about them, you know, either with words or melody. And from an audience perspective, and as a critic, like, to me, a successful artist is an artist that does that. Like, they're successful in the world and they're successful for the community. And I will give them my money and wear their shirts and whatever, write their stories. If they're doing that, and maybe that, you know, whether or not that like results in more dollars for them is I don't know.
We'll find out.
Well, also, what you're saying, Kim, and it makes me think back on what Lizzie started with this of like a fan being like, why aren't you in a bigger room? Mm-hmm. It's also the assumption that everybody wants to be in bigger rooms, mm-hmm. fans mm-hmm. and musicians alike, because that's what's so funny to me is like there's so many different settings to receive music in. And I, as a music fan, don't want to go to an arena and don't want to go to a Lollapalooza. And there's a whole ecosystem of people who love to listen to music in tiny rooms mm-hmm. or in living rooms and performers who also see the magic in that. Well, with our podcast, The Other 22 Hours, it's been really fun to and enlightening to hear from people like Jim Sonnefeld from Hootie and the Blowfish, mm-hmm. who is like, he spends his time going around like self-booking his own solo shows. And like, those are just as rewarding and mm-hmm. in from that he's shared. And I could imagine that. So I feel like it's almost like a little insulting of like, why is this not a value just because it's smaller? And I think of like, last time I saw Lizzie in person, she took me to go see Kara Jackson at like a little room at Soho House. And it was just incredible. I don't think, and it was incredible because it was so intimate and small. And we were sitting on like a little couch right underneath Kara. And I could hear, and I didn't have to like, I wasn't trying to like see over some tall guy standing in front of me. And like, that would have been a very different experience if we were at, you know, the Basement East in a sold out show or whatever, right. you know?
Yeah. Tyler Ramsey mm-hmm. Talked about that in our conversation.
Was Tyler Ramsey standing in front of you?
Yeah. He's tall, right?
Yeah.
Excuse me. Hey,
weirdly, Tyler popped up at the Kara Jackson. The Jackson show, standing in front of everyone. It was
down in front. For those of you that don't know, Tyler Ramsey's a great songwriter from Western North Carolina, and he had his career and then joined Band of Horses and was the guitar player for them for a decade. And he had a very solid realization that, you know, playing Madison Square Garden for three nights and, you know, the rooms that Band of Horses would play was not for his music. And he made a solid decision. He's like, my music is for smaller rooms. And to play those bigger rooms, I'm going to have to change my music. And I'm going to have to change the way that it's delivered from the records and all that. And he's like, that doesn't serve me. That doesn't serve the audience. That doesn't serve my music. And so it's been a conscious decision of his to keep it in small rooms. And I think that's absolutely beautiful.
I would love to turn the conversation a little bit towards Cindy and Kim. You guys write about music, talk about music, interview artists. And we're in a moment where like so many jobs have been cut in journalism. It's kind of like a buzzy topic of like, what's going to happen with journalism? Have you had to change and recalibrate your ambitions for your own career as you've seen your industry change? And have there been times where the reality of the industry has been in conflict with the high standards you set and want to maintain for yourself?
Who wants to go first?
Go ahead.
Yes, Cindy. Cindy, go off.
Radio is very toxic. Commercial radio, I can't even imagine. Public radio, it's like all of the stations that I've worked at have had some kind of issues with them, except mm-hmm. for WUNC Music in the Triangle. But that station just went off the air a few months ago.
Only the good die young.
So I made a choice to leave several radio jobs because the work environment was so bad. I mean, one was good enough that I stuck around for like 15 years, but it wasn't like great, you know, and the other one I stuck around for 10 months. Uh-huh. And it's heartbreaking because I love radio, but radio sucks.
Yeah.
It is not good.
And you're someone that holds yourself to a very high standard. Like I know this from working with you.
That's correct. So I found that like making your own opportunities are really where it's at, you know. It's helpful to, for me, I got lucky. Like, I do have a day job that I'm able to live off of. And it is radio related. Shout out to Vogue Alley. And the, you know, the podcast has led to like so many amazing and fruitful opportunities. And most of them have not been paid gigs. Also, like, my spouse is a doctor, you know, so like I've got a good situation over here, but I'm so heartbroken about my industry. I don't even know where to begin.
Maybe we need to do a radio episode.
I feel like the one station that's doing it right. I mean, there have to be several others, but the one station that's doing it right is KEXP in Seattle, where it's like very listener forward, very heart centered. Their morning show host, John Richards, he's my hero, my absolute hero. And he, like, one of his taglines is he will say like, KEXP, you are not alone. And then like starts playing music. And it's like emotional to like listen to his show every day. And that is like so rare, you know. Radio has just been destroyed, and it's like a nice thing to get a paying job in radio, but like I am not going to be in a situation where I get to do a show like John Richards does, which is like what I would want to do. So I've gone ahead and made my own opportunity here on this podcast. It's not radio, but it's something I love doing, and it's a type of music that I really care about, and I consider myself very lucky.
Yeah, it sounds like you've had to like divorce your high standards and your ambitions and your dreams from like money and institutions, which I feel like is something that we're all navigating in one way or another. Do you feel that way too, Kim?
Absolutely.
I see you nodding.
Yeah. Same, ditto, all the things in print journalism. You know, when at some point in the last 20, I mean, I've been doing this for 20 years, which makes me feel old, but at some point things shifted from criticism as a valuable opportunity to contextualize music and explore what works and what doesn't work and what, and to sort of translate artistic process for the general public and all the things that I fell in love with in that job, shifted to like, we don't want to put out bad vibes. We just want to say good things. And if you have a negative, if you have a review that is negative or that it's not completely glowing, we don't want it. Or if you want to like explore why this album from this beloved artist is not their finest work, we don't want to do that. And to me, that has, you know, in my view, that has like mirrored this moment in society where, you know, the dumpster fire has happened and we all want good vibes, you know, and I get that. And discourse has become so toxic. And I think that there's something to the sort of decline of criticism and the rise of toxic discourse when our writers and our word people aren't allowed to show how to be critical and loving at the same time, that echoes out. And so to me, you know, I stepped away from No Depression, gosh, 5 years ago now, and to write a book about a woman who was like a model ally in the struggle for justice for all people. And my work on that project, Zilphia Horton, I should say her name because nobody says it, was illuminating in the sense that I was, you know, sort of coming to terms with this, this unfortunate evolution of music criticism at the same time that I was exploring social justice movements and the progressive South, and in the world, Black Lives Matter was happening, and all of the all of the white folks were suddenly paying attention to the fact that Black men and women were being murdered by police. And I'm totally losing the theme of this podcast right now, but
go off.
but I feel like it's all, for me, it is all parts of the same whole. Mm-hmm. And I think that because art is a way that art is like the nervous system of humanity, mm-hmm. and it's the way we process the world. And when our art and our commentary about art and our thoughts about art and the way that art is accessible to us, when all of that turns toxic because capitalism is fucked, mm-hmm. As far as it can fuck the world, then we've got a problem. We've got a humanity problem. Mm-hmm. And I think my interest after I finished A Singing Army, the Sylvia Horton and the Highlander Folk School on University of Texas Press 2022.
go get it.
I had this moment of I know how to write a biography about women in music, and I could be that person that does that thing. But I don't want to do that. I want to, tell stories that matter to me, mm-hmm. and I want to get to my vulnerable places, and I want to do art, you know? And so I've had this shift, this slow shift away from the music business, writing, working on books, that have nothing to do with music, but everything to do with music. And, now my ambition is separate from the music industry, but I think is in the same arena as folk music, mm-hmm. In the sense that it speaks on behalf of, people that are busting their asses to make a better world.
The idea that art is the nervous system of humanity, I think, is such a good point, especially because what you're talking about when it comes to the decline of criticism, I feel like one of the big issues is that we look at online discourse as people can attack and then run away, and we don't stay in conversation with each other. We don't stay for the nuance. I love this artist. I see what they were going for. It's not quite working here and here. Here's what's really interesting about it. Here's the context it comes from, is a lot less interesting than band bad, throw them away. And that's also really limiting in our social movements as well. When we want to, mm-hmm. There are a lot of us that are not able to say, here's where I want to lovingly call you in and stay together. And it's together that we get forward, right? If we just throw a little attack and jump away, that's not really making progress in the world or in art.
Yeah. And we're not going back.
No.
Yeah. No, I've been stuck to the DNC this week. I think you're totally right. And I think that, I had a thought and it's gone. Somebody else go.
Well, I was at what Lizzie just said on throwing an attack and going away versus here's where I can lovingly call you in. And that's mm-hmm. how we move forward. The last several years, I've thought a lot about this the online activism and mm-hmm. the proclamations and mm-hmm. the directives that we saw, especially around the Black Lives Matter movement. From all sorts of people. It was always really interesting to me. My background, I have a degree in sociology, and I studied social movements of the 20th century and how music, popular music, played a role in it. And I've always kind of observed what's been happening the last several years. And like, online isn't the place where we can have real conversations. And even like artists and friends that I love who are on the kind of seen as like the extreme left, sometimes the rhetoric used, I'm like, what's the goal here? Yeah. Is it to throw away the people who disagree with us? What are we going to do with all of them? Or what's the goal? Is it to actually try and change hearts and minds and mm-hmm. have a collective like growth and evolution? And how do we do that? I don't think being like, you know, you're fucked up because you're ignorant and you are fearful of people. So therefore you've become hateful. So now we hate you and you need to go away is really the tactic that's going to yeah. build an inclusive democracy and community.
Cindy,
all of this discussion that we're talking about right now makes me want to know, like, when have there been times when your career ambition has struggled with your personal belief system and personal desires, like whether political or Aaron and Michaela, you have started a family. That's another, you know, personal belief system and personal desires. Like, how have you reconciled those two? So we're kind of like on topic and off topic with this question.
No, I think it's the logical next step.
I can start with just career wise. It was so, it's been challenging for me moving to Nashville, which I've been so curious about Lizzie's experience mm-hmm. moving to Nashville this last year. We moved to Nashville 10 years ago and we met in New York City. We went to the New School. We went to a jazz conservatory and I had a second degree in sociology and American history. And we had, you know, a super diverse multicultural community in New York City. And Aaron was heavily involved in the Northeastern Brazilian music scene. And we're doing just like very different, a very different scene. And moving to Nashville, and I would occasionally dip my toes in kind of like publishing and mainstream country writing. And it was very hard for me to reconcile of like, how could I participate in this industry and music? Even I had to reconcile like my love for old school country songwriters who were, as I dug deeper, were probably very racist, misogynistic. So that was kind of, that's been a process for me of how to reconcile that and also make choices of like, I can't be quiet about my values and my belief systems. So therefore, like, I will probably never be able to like politically maneuver a career in a path that you're having to like rub elbows with people who are massive Trump supporters, because that to me is not a difference in politics. That's like a difference in humanity at this point. Mm-hmm. So that for me has been a big thing of progressively being like, my value system will always, I will never not be able to talk about it from my artist platform, but I hope to always do it with kindness and empathy that invites conversation, but like, I will never not share my political beliefs. And again, to me, it's not even politics. It's just like humanity, like mm-hmm. believing that everybody deserves the same respect and kindness. And family life. We talk about it a lot on our podcast of just, you know, for me being the woman who's also a working artist and bearing children, it's been like pretty shocking to me how much I feel like I've experienced discrimination. And like, I'm always like, I feel like I'm pregnant right now. And was at a festival with our second child. And thank you. And I feel like in some ways I have like a scarlet letter on me mm-hmm. that I have to go around being like, guys, I'm still going to be here. Like mm-hmm. also to industry people of like, I'm still bookable. I still will do this because that's our plan as long as it continues to work for us, which is completely dependent on Aaron being willing to carry the load of childcare, which nobody bats an eye when it's a heterosexual couple and it's the dude out on the road. And Aaron's the first one to point that out. Like, when Georgia, our daughter, was like 8 months, we went on a 2-week tour with the Milk Carton Kids and Aaron, and like 3 weeks in Europe where Aaron just comes to drive and stay back at the hotel and take care of our daughter. And people, I would tell him how people would be like, oh my God, he's incredible. And he was like, that's nice. I like the compliment. And he was like, but if the roles were reversed, would you be getting as many compliments? I was like,
I hate that. And it's so condescending, as if like you would need a little sticker for taking care of your child.
Oh, the best is when people are like, oh, you're babysitting? And I'm like,
Jesus Christ.
It's my kid. It's called being a parent.
No. It's interesting that you like very perceptively feel that there's this pressure to reassure people that you are still exploitable. Like, yes, I will still work just because I'm a human person going through this phase of life where I'm having children, and just because I'm going through a human experience doesn't mean I'm not still useful to capitalism. And it's so gross that you're being pressured to reassure people of that.
I've had the exact opposite experience where all of a sudden I'm a parent and people are like, oh, well, I would call you for this gig, but it just doesn't pay enough. You know, you're a parent. You gotta like, I've had the exact opposite where I get more respect and I get more authority in a way. It might be that I have more gray hairs, but it's still like, it is a weird thing.
It's because you're a man.
I've talked about it with other men that have kids, and they're like, no, you get more. It's all of a sudden like, oh, this is like serious. He has like a family to support. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I do, but for the, you know, the majority of the 17 years we've been together, Michaela has been the breadwinner. Mm-hmm. I mean, I still have a family to support. And I still do my thing. Sometimes I'm the breadwinner, but it's like, this is a very equal situation here.
Mm. Wow.
And also, I just want to say it's like, it's not in my mind. I've had direct conversations with like my booking agent who was like, oh no, this is going to be too hard. I would be so worried for you. Like, and so it's a very real, not everybody experiences it. I talk to so many women about this. I think solo artists, females versus women who are in bands, it's a little bit more protected, at least in my anecdotal conversations. But the thing I've realized, though, is that the music industry is like essentially dehumanizing in a way of like, if you have a personal life, any burdens, then you are not appealing because you should be able to be exploited 24/7 all year round. If you have anything that could take you away, family to take care of, parents to take care of, well, you are not of interest to us because you're not going to be able to work as hard and we're not going to be able to use you as much. Mm-hmm. And it's taken me a long time to be like, man, the goal for me isn't anymore to make my personal life so spare and minimal that it never gets in the way. Because also that fucks me up as an artist, that my writing and my work to me feels so much richer the deeper my family and personal life is, and the more I value and prioritize that. But for the business side of music, those are strikes against you.
Ugh. Lizzie.
Yes.
Now you answer the question.
I have come to realize that a lot of my peers have very different ambitions than I do. And that has been a very freeing realization. For example, a few times, like 2020 has been mentioned when like a lot of white people were very concerned with realizing that Black people exist and that bad things are happening to us. Sorry, I'm being sarcastic about it, but that is how it felt. My DMs were popping with people apologizing to me, wanting to support me, wanting to interview me. I don't really see that a lot structurally has changed since then. And that has been disheartening. But it has also just let me know that like my goals are different than other artists' goals. Because I have seen so many people that like I consider like in my lane work with openly racist, openly misogynistic, abusive men. And I thought we were all going to this place where we weren't doing that anymore. But what it has made me realize is that for me, success and ambition and self-determination have everything to do with having the courage to say no to things and to know that other opportunities are coming. Like I was really blown away this summer when I saw a bunch of artists that I really like going on tour with Morgan Wallen. And I was like, I thought that we weren't doing this. I thought that we actually took this seriously, but most of us don't. And I think it takes a real courage to say no to a little bit of money and a little bit of an opportunity because you know that your soul and your integrity are at stake. And I think that to be an ambitious artist, you have to take your integrity very seriously. And so like, I think there are times when like I've spoken out about my politics and been, I had a festival set canceled this summer because I spoke about Palestine and the organizers asked me not to perform. I've had donors say like, we're not going to donate to this venue anymore because this artist spoke about Palestine. And so like, there are very real consequences for saying, no, I'm not going to go along. And I've accepted the consequences, which feels really, really good actually. Cause on the other side of that is everything you get to do because you've kept your heart and soul and values intact. Okay, so this was like a mean screed about people I don't respect, but it also is like, I think it's actually a really hopeful thing. Like the more it started to dawn on me that there wasn't much money in this for me, the more, if you start with the assumption like, okay, I'm not going to get rich off of this. The music industry is declining. Artists who speak their minds are not rewarded for it. I'm a woman and a lot of people don't want to hear what I have to say at all. What does that leave me with? What am I actually doing this for? I'm doing it because I need to write songs and sing them. And it gives you a lot of freedom when you're not waiting for people's approval. Mm-hmm. Does that answer your question, Cindy?
Yeah.
Like you have to be able to say no to be able to do what you want. Like I think as artists, we have to start there.
And I think it's what you want more of.
Yeah.
I've had this conversation with people like me continually talking about my booking agent who I won't ever name by name on. It'd be pretty easy for people to figure it out probably if they did some internet sleuthing, but I won't name by name on like on the podcast or on the internet, but I tell people because he's a powerful booking agent, but I continually speak about it because I've processed my shame around it and don't have any shame anymore and see that I was discriminated against. And in another field, if there were other structures, there are laws that would have protected me from being discriminated against and losing opportunity for becoming pregnant. And I talk about it because I want other people to know when they're in that situation that they could have more options or strength or confidence. And someone said to me recently, because they've shared something about a sexual harassment experience or something and not wanting to share. And I was like, man, why are we always protecting predators? We're never, you know, saying by name. And she said to me, well, Michaela, you're particularly fearless. And I was like, I don't think I am. I think I just like don't have that much at stake because I don't have like a huge operation where I'm paying a lot of people or making a ton of money. So I don't really have anything to lose. And I'm like, what are the gatekeepers not going to let me in through the gates that I'm already not getting in?
And there's not like this big bag that you're like missing out on, like the folk music. You're not missing out on the folk music wealth that others are getting. Like truly, what do we have to lose is what I want to say to so many artists in our position. Like, why aren't you speaking your mind? What do you have to lose? They've taken everything from us.
Yeah. And I'm like, I think I don't want it enough then. I want my integrity more than I want that. And also I've been around long enough and have enough friends who've had those big moments that then I hear about, wait, but behind the scenes, like, on the internet, that looked like a huge moment for you, but like you were getting paid what? And losing money for this and had no place to stay. And like, the illusion has been, just completely exploded for me. Like, it's just like not real anymore in my head.
As someone that, again, isn't like public facing with the work that I do, I'm business to business in a way where my job is to support artists. Like my viewpoint on the whole thing is like, nobody has anything to lose. Really? I mean, okay. So you speak up and it raises this you know, it somehow you speaking up then goes viral, I guess. And then all of a sudden more people, we started talking about Morgan Wallen. It's like, there are far more people that know about Morgan Wallen after it came to light how awful of a human being he was than before.
Well, that's the point. He's famous because he's a racist. It's not because of his amazing music. I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
It needs to be said, and it needs to be said on record. We in the music industry need to start saying out loud that he's not a good musician and he doesn't have anything to offer other than white grievance. Sorry, go on.
No, I hear you for sure.
Sorry, you know, so I had to get it on the pod.
Yeah, there are only... There, to me, in my perspective, there are only wins in speaking up and sharing your truth. Because either people are going to like aggressively agree with you or aggressively disagree with you.
Yeah.
And either way, you are being a leader. To me, like what Kim was mentioning is
who you are.
Yeah. What Kim was mentioning as, you know, an audience member having to show that the audience wants to show up. They want to feel things. They want to move. They want to be basically led through the spectrum of emotions as a human being. You know, and I like to bring attention to the fact that, like, you know, social media is what it is in our industry and is massive, but they're all called followers. So you need to give somebody something to follow. Can't just be like the plastic bag floating in the breeze, you know, that people are like, oh, look at that. That's cool. Like, be yourself, you know, like be yourself fully and give people something to follow. Like, I'm really sorry to hear that your experience was what it was, Lizzie, with like venues and promoters backing up, but like, who's to say there aren't twice as many that are like, that Lizzie.
Yeah.
Call her. Who do we call? Who do we get?
Yeah. You know? I mean, it's like, I might not be, I'm probably limiting some paid opportunities by running my mouth all the time about abortion and Palestine and my life and what it is to be a woman in the world. Mm-hmm. But it has also brought to me real friends and allies that I wouldn't have met otherwise. And okay, I actually want to transition because we're coming, you know, we're at about an hour and this.
Oh, that's good. Cause I was just about to bring up a topic that would blow everything up. So let's not go there.
Okay. We can, but I also want to do something, that's not just talking. Like, can we manifest something? Because I think we're all ambitious people. And as much as I like to talk about the obstacles that we're facing, I want to hear in the most sincere way possible, what is an ambition that you have for yourself and your work that you want to see happen in the world? Like, I want us to each go around and say one concrete thing that we want to see happen. And then we listen back to this episode in 10 years. Are you guys game to do that? It's a little vulnerable.
Yeah, I'm game.
Cindy, go first.
Okay, great. I'll go first. So I've talked about this before with Amy at the Bluegrass situation, but my ambition is, and my goal for this podcast is to be bigger than me and Lizzie, that like it can live on if like one day Lizzie and I want to pass it on to somebody else, you know, and it just keeps growing and growing and serves the community and serves everybody in like a really wonderful, cool, and fun way.
I love that. Kim, do you have an ambition you want to share?
Mine is not a huge ambition. I have a lot of stories to tell, stories about real people, stories about history and music, stories about imagined situations. And I want to get them all out of my head.
Michaela, do you have an ambition? I think you guys can each have an ambition and then maybe a collective ambition since you are a family.
I think my ambition is probably to keep trying to make an impact through my songwriting, our podcast, my essay writing, and hopefully someday a book. I don't know what word to use. Not promotes, but invites more people to be comfortable with vulnerability and kindness and honesty.
My ambition would be to help artists make records that are uniquely themselves in a way that allows audiences to step into themselves being uniquely themselves, and in general changes the world so that people can be more open and vulnerable and connected with each other.
Do we have a family ambition?
Two doctors.
Yeah. Their children are not artists.
Yeah. Don't do what I have done. It's your advice.
No, our daughter already says, I'm an artist. Mm-hmm. She is.
She's a painter.
We also believe everyone's an artist.
Yes.
I would say our family, I'll just speak for us.
Please.
Our family goal is to keep working together and mm-hmm. building our collective businesses, artistic endeavors together, and to raise good, loving humans mm-hmm. and show people that you can also have a family and pursue your passions in life.
Mm-hmm. Oh my goodness.
Lizzie.
Yes. Okay. I'm going to manifest two very concrete artistic goals. One, I'm going to release a classic love song that stands the test of time, at least one. Mm-hmm. And number two, I am going to host a big ass festival, the proceeds of which fund abortions in the South.
Yes. That's great. Yeah.
Popcorn style, are you guys down to do a lightning round about ambition?
Sure.
Okay. We have a bunch of questions and I'm just going to quickly throw them to you guys, and don't think too hard. Just there. It's a would you rather. Okay.
Okay.
Aaron, would you rather have a billboard in Times Square featuring you and your music, something you've worked on, or own the cutest dog in the world?
I'm going to go with the billboard. Okay. Just because I'm not a huge dog guy.
Whoa.
Whoa.
Sorry.
Whoa, hold up.
Sorry. I have a kid. I don't need a dog.
Yeah.
We're welcoming.
These are all like musician related. So everybody kind of just put yourself in the shoes. Kim, would you rather win Album of the Year at the Grammys, have $2 million after taxes in take-home pay, or get one full year of not working, like a paid year of rest?
That's a tough call after a summer with the kids mm-hmm. home. But I would say the $2 million because I love to give money away.
Yes.
And I would love to just like leave a tip or drop it in somebody's tip jar, you know, at the coffee shop or something.
Or mail it to my home address, which I will provide after the podcast. Cindy, would you rather open for...
I don't want to do this one.
You don't want to do this one. Okay.
I think Michaela do this one.
Would you rather open for the Gillian Welch tour or be given the reins to program Newport Folk and Jazz for 1 year, or have a pet dolphin?
That's easy. Open the Gillian Welch tour, because then I could listen to them every night.
Every single night. The new songs are so good. Okay, Cindy, would you rather win all the awards at Americana Fest, all of them, Lifetime Achievement and New Artist, get to walk the red carpet and win Best Dressed with Prince as your date, or walk the full Appalachian Trail and have perfect weather the entire time?
I would walk the trail.
You'd walk
Prince.
The trail. Do you think Prince would go?
Yeah.
He would hike with you.
I would hike the trail. That's a good choice, Cindy.
Should I ask you? Oh, thank you. Lizzie, I'll ask you this
okay,
one.
Okay, go.
Lizzie, would you rather have a number one song on the Billboard Hot 100, or if you never had to clean your house or wash a dish again, like you have a self-cleaning house?
That is easy because I like to clean. Put me on the Billboard 100. And you know what? As a matter of fact, put my classic love song that I'm going to write.
There it
a
is.
A slow and weepy love song at number one on the Billboard wow. Hot 100.
Mm-hmm. Are you talking like Desiree style?
Yeah. Totally.
Oh, that song. Good.
Can we cue up some Desiree to, as the fade out music to this episode? Because I think that would be super chill. Okay, Kim. Can I talk to our guests, Cindy?
Yes.
Or is that cool?
That's cool.
Kim Rohl, Michaela Ann, Aaron Schaefer-Hase, Cindy Howes, Issa Burke in absentia. This has been such a soulful and amazing episode of Folk Debate Club. I'm like so grateful that all of you shared your experiences and your hopes and your dreams and your frustrations and your rage. It's been so beautiful. Thank you.
Thanks everybody.
Thank you.
This episode of Basic Folk was produced by CJ Nungesser. Alex Stanton composes our music. Basic Folk is on the Bluegrass Situation podcast network. You can find all of our episodes there. You can search for Basic Folk on the SiriusXM app. You can check us out on Folk Alley's mobile app or folkalley.com. Get to our website, basicfolk.com, or you can find us wherever you listen to podcasts. If you enjoyed this episode, why don't you share it with a friend? Perhaps your younger cousin who has just graduated college and doesn't really know what to do and wants to be an artist, but also maybe wants to be a stockbroker. This might help them make a decision one way or another. Not saying that they should decide one way or another, and there's no saying that they can't be both. You should support your cousin and share this episode with them. All right, we'll talk to you next time. Bye.